911, what's your emergency?
Yeah, do you guys have the organic Irish CBD five-leaf clover blend?
What?
Very okay, pregnant again, pause, not, Ryan. Good job.
Was, again, was not trying to go that pregnant with the pause. Sorry if to our listeners, if you hear any noise in the background of my recording session, I play D&D with a group of very boisterous and charismatic actors, and so we were doing mini sessions today, and there's a mini session currently going. And I dipped out of it because we had a commitment, and I told them to keep the noise down, but they are actors and they are in character. So damn. If any of the noise bleeds through, that's why. But anyways, thank you guys for, tuning into the First Risk podcast. Welcome back. Welcome yes. back to a thrilling installment. Today, Jane, we are discussing season 3, episode 17.
Powerless.
What was it called? Powerless. Oh. That's right. They only said it a couple of times in the episode, so I didn't really get the title.
They only said it a couple of times? I can't believe you're saying that. They could not stop saying it.
I know, right? Like, they only said it, like, once or twice. No, they could not stop saying it.
I took your joke at face value.
Oh, you're good.
I thought you were being serious.
We on the First Risk podcast have another trapped and stuck style episode on our hands.
This episode
excited.
Is coming to us from Queen Kristen Rydell. This is interesting. She directed this one. I didn't know
she
directed at all, but yeah, she directed this one, and she also co-wrote it along with Lindsay Beaulieu. So we have our kind of dream team of these two women who we think have been kind of up and down in their writing this season, right? I think Lindsay wrote Rage, which we were not a fan of. And of course, Kristen wrote Athena Begins, right? So it's like sort of this double-edged sword. Because those episodes too, like there were things that we liked about them and a lot of things we really didn't like. So I was kind of interested to see this episode that they collaborated on. I thought this episode on the whole was pretty well paced. Like, I was really enjoying kind of the pacing of it, which I think is generally true across the board of Kristen Rydell's episodes. I haven't, like, identified as much of a pattern with Beaulieu's episodes to, like, know so much. But, you know, I didn't think every moment of this one was perfect, but I was enjoying, like, how fast it went by. That's so depressing.
No, I totally
that's what
agree.
I like about episodes now in season 3. I'm like, well, I like that it was over fast.
No, but like I agree, and like I get you, because like it did go by quickly, and I was appreciating the pace of the episode. It kind of swung in the other direction because I thought that there was so much stuff happening in this episode that certain things weren't as fleshed out as I would have liked them to be. Because there were a lot of competing plot lines this time around. I think I can identify five, I want to say five. And that's a lot for 42 minutes, especially when some of them are very heavy. So
that is, yeah. Yeah, the elephant in the room is that like the culmination of this episode is an extremely, extremely dark sequence, kind of darker than what the show usually does, and I don't know if I'm a huge fan. I mean, we'll talk about it. I don't know. I don't really know where I stand on that. We'll just maybe start talking about the episode and get to it when we get to it.
Yeah, I'm down for that. So you said Kristen and Lindsay co-wrote this episode, and this is actually interesting because I liked this episode more than I did Lindsay's first, and I believe her second episode on the show as well. She wrote another one that I wasn't particularly fond of, if I can recall, but I don't remember what it was, so I guess it wasn't that memorable. But I remember this one, you know what I mean? Because these are like big storylines, and also I just have to say, this episode ends with the cliffhanger of all cliffhangers. I queened out. It was a slay and a
people
half.
People died. I just looked it up. Lindsay wrote Rage, and she also wrote season 3 episode 11, Seize the Day, which yes, you were not a big fan of. I
yes.
think I wasn't either, but that does mean she gave us Justin the Pole Guy, which I think is something. Was that the one
something.
With the camping trip or not? I don't think 11 was the, I don't think Seize the Day was the camping trip episode.
It was the Albert episode. Lindsay, you have to step it up because your episodes are proving memorable only for the wrong reasons.
Is that her fault though, or is that us?
I mean, I remember one of my only critiques that I remember specifically about the episode Seize the Day is that I thought the writing was bad.
Okay, well, so why don't we just dive into season 3, episode 17, Powerless?
Yes, Powerless. Oh, I wonder, and I'm just spitballing here, I wonder if anyone's going to be feeling particularly powerless this episode.
Alexa, play Blackout from In the Heights.
Here's the thing about episode titles like this.
Okay, I guess we're not jumping right into the episode.
I just have to disclaim this. There are thousands of times on this show before this where characters individually feel powerless.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue it's one of the hallmarks of the show because they're put in peril all the time.
True.
Side characters, calls, and the main characters as well. And I'm sure the word powerless has been said plenty of times before on the show, but when the episode is called Powerless, it really draws your attention to it.
Well, yeah, I guess.
So I think that's where the stuck phenomenon comes from, the trapped phenomenon comes from.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And what's funny about that is then like you can't ever ignore it again. Like I think it was in season 8 when I was starting to notice that like every episode the characters were saying stuck or trapped a lot, and at the time I was like, wow, I guess Tim Minear's listening to our podcast. But in hindsight it's like, I think those are just normal words to say a lot, but the show has like poisoned me to always pay attention whenever they say that.
I completely forgot that we started this podcast while season 8 was like early first airing. I think we started right after the Bean-Nado.
Remember when we were happy? Anyway, this episode opens with a mom and kid driving to the middle of nowhere to go on a hot air balloon ride. And the daughter isn't into it because she's upset that her parents are divorcing. And she has a great unsubtle line where she's like, "Mom, I'm a kid. I don't get to have any power." You know how kids talk?
Oh, wow. It's a manifestation of the overarching theme. They're going up. This is their whole scheme, okay? And we've seen something like this before. But last time it was a little different. They're going up in a private hot air balloon.
Is there such a thing as a public hot air balloon?
What I meant by private when I wrote it down was not the like private ownership. I think I was referring more so to the fact that it was a private thing for two people as opposed to like, you know, a group thing. But then maybe I also don't know how many people an air balloon seats.
Mom Donnie wants to provide government controlled hot air balloons for all the citizens of New York.
When will the First Respodcast Institute ranked choice voting?
But you know, it's foggy out today, and the mom gets a little, as they're starting to go up in the air balloon, the mom is like, "It seems foggy today. Is it a good time to go up?" And the driver is like, "Well, it's just the marine layer. Like, we should be fine." They go up. There's like a hot air balloon themed song. Needle drop.
Okay,
or something.
You didn't know what it was either. I did not know what this song was.
I looked on the IMDb. It's some like 60s. It's by that songwriter. I forget his name, but famous old. I just was scrolling down the IMDb and got distracted because the first review is 1 star, guilt tripping daughter. I'm sorry, I feel the need to pause and do a dramatic reading of this review. Guilt tripping daughter. Dear know-it-all teens, you do not have the... Oh, I'm still on the Seize the Day. I'm so sorry. You guys, this is such a mess of a way to start the episode, but I need to... Okay, this is a 1-star review of the episode, season 3, episode 11, Seize the Day. Guilt-tripping daughter, dear know-it-all teens, .. You do not have the right to tell an adult, all caps, let alone your father, that updating his will is capitalized for some reason, prior to surgery for a brain tumor after undergoing radiation, that he is giving up, 3 exclamation points. This show does tend to send mixed, inaccurate messages, but, comma, this one is a doozy. getting your affairs in order before any kind of surgery, and especially in the face of a cancer is capitalized as well, diagnosis, especially all caps, when you have a family, is something that must be done, all caps, and not a sign of giving up. It's called planning. Step aside, child, with your guilt trip to an adult who is already scared and needs to take their own steps to prepare. Oh, this was posted. Wow. Holy shit. This was posted October 7th, 2023. I assume that's unrelated. 7 people have marked this review as helpful. 9 people have downvoted it. So let us know in the comments whether you agree or disagree with DDVM Schmidt.
The first thing that jumps out at me is that this has the exact same energy as that, like, that Tumblr fandom post that called underage fans little minor shit beasts. This is the target demo of the show, by the way. This is who they're trying to appeal to most to sell space for their commercials for, I don't know, Gillette razors or something. You know, this is the target demo of the show. So when we talk from, like, a sort of leftist political sort of Gen Z eye, it actually might benefit us to keep this in perspective.
This specific person's type of perspective.
We can be disappointed all we want, but, like, we're not buying the razors and the soap and the, well, I guess we are. I use soap and a razor. What I'm saying is, we're not middle America divorced dads who need to yell at fictional teenagers.
DDBM Schmidt probably stands for divorce dad. Bad mom Schmidt.
I'd love to know what the kids grew up to be like.
Also, to be clear, this is the only written review for the episode on IMDb. Sorry to derail us right then. I just felt the need to.
I'm DDBM Schmidt. I can't stop yelling at teenagers and schmitting myself in public. Blah.
Not schmitting himself. I'm assuming it's a him. I could be wrong. I was just trying to find the soundtrack section for episode 17. Okay, it was a song called Up, Up and Away, written by Jimmy Webb, who's a rather famous songwriter of the era. I think he collaborated with, I don't know, like Simon and Garfunkel or something, performed by The Fifth Dimension. I don't know, it was just one of those like 60s songs with that sort of Burt Bacharach sound, you know?
So the song is hot, it's hot air balloon music.
The point is that the song LA is very on the nose, you know, drink music. For on the nose, needle drop. Let's get this episode, let's pull ourselves together. Okay.
Permission to yell at a tween for a second.
Sure.
I get this girl, and I totally understand everything she's going through, and I think she's spitting absolute fire when it comes to, like, the parent stuff. Because it's written to be very on the nose. And at the same time, like, girl, you're sulking. Your mom took you up in the hot air balloon and you're sulking. Now, granted, I wouldn't have gotten on in the first place. Hot air balloons, they're up there with camping for me as just, like, immediate instant death. But, like, I don't know. Whatever. But I would never do this because, like, this, and this is why, because the wind kicks up and immediately rocks the boat, and they go to set down the balloon, but oh my god, it is perilous. And the beautiful man who is piloting the thing, he seems pretty competent. I don't know how these ropes work that he's throwing back. I don't know what that does to anchor the thing. But the minute they step out, the mom steps out first and then goes to get her daughter. You know how you're supposed to put the mask on your face before your kids or whatever.
Right.
But hey, a gust of wind kicks the balloon up, sends the man flying back, hitting his head on a rock. The daughter is ripped out of the mom's arms. She's still in the balloon and it flies away.
Yeah. It's almost, I think I had to, like, rewind the episode to even see how the balloon operator, like, hit his head, because it happens so fast. It's like a comedy beat. They have this rocky landing, the mom gets out, the guy gets out, like, immediately gets knocked down against a rock and hits his head and is out cold, and then the balloon goes back
up. Seemingly, by the way, seemingly the only rock.
Yeah.
The only rock in the field.
A very unlucky place for that rock to be. But, you know, there's a 911 call. I've lost my daughter, blah, blah, blah. Bury the lead. She's in a fucking hot air balloon. The 118 arrives. Buck is, like, already bitterly remembering his failed hot air balloon date with Abby from season one. Again, the show is, like, invoking Abby to remind us that she exists before she returns in the finale.
I have to say something about the 911 call itself.
Mm.
Which is that, you know, it's a very sort of banal call. Like, not the when she's calling the 911 itself. The mom, she's like, Sophie, she's flying away. Her daughter's name's Sophie. Sophie, she's flying away. And Maddie goes, I'm sorry, ma'am. Did you just say flying? And, like, I can't overstate how long Maddie's been working at dispatch now.
I know.
She can't keep being surprised by this.
I know it's, every time. I know it's just for TV, for dramatic effect, but it is like, come on, you're a 911 dispatcher. Like, you don't get to have a moment to be, like, taken aback. You have to just do your job.
You can't be this confused. It's like that John Mulaney bit about Ice-T working at SVU. Like, right. you can't treat every case like your first case, you know?
So you're saying a girl got murdered? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the 118 responds, turns out the winds are blowing at upwards of 40 miles per hour. I don't know. I can drive faster than that. But I like the girl is in the hot air balloon and there's like a radio in there. So they're trying to catch up with it in the fire truck. And they're going to use the ropes to steer or something. I don't know how these things work. And I'm not interested in finding out.
See, but the hot air balloons were publicly owned by the people, you could seize means of hot air balloon piloting and you could learn these things.
Exactly. Exactly. Communize, socialize the hot air balloon industry, please.
Yes.
Please. The people are begging for it. Okay. She has to land it herself using the onboard radio, I suppose, because they left their really long, really big net at home that day, and so they can't just catch it out of the sky. And she's being a wimp. She's being an absolute wimp about it. Oh, it's a metaphor for being a kid in a crazy situation at home. Whoa, she feels, I know you feel powerless, Sophie, but you're not. You have the power, girl. The theme, I don't know what it is. I can't crack it.
Right. The girl manages to get low enough that the 118 can, like, rush out into the open field to catch the basket. Buck immediately jumps into the basket, brings the balloon. The rest of the way down, he just starts, like, pulling on the ropes like he knows how to do this. I was thinking, like, presumably he doesn't really know how to fly a hot air balloon. Imagine if he'd just, like, pulled the wrong rope or something and, like, ruined everything, just sent them back into the sky.
I love the way that he jumps into the basket too. It was so golden retriever. Like, it's just like, oh, you know, Bobby threw a stick and he went to go fetch it. It was very funny. But yeah, no, that's a good point actually about how he knew the ropes, because, like, he didn't get in the hot air balloon with Abby.
That being said, knowing Buck, maybe he did do a ton of research before planning his hot air balloon date with Abby, where he, like, learned how to pilot it in case it turned into a 911 scenario. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's also possible. I could see that for him. So there's the answer. Thank you. Sorry, your welcome show. We just did your homework for you. And so, Buck is a hero, and he gets the girl out. The mom asks, you know, if she's okay. And he says, she's in one piece. She's in one piece?
Damn. Okay. Anyways. Well, the little girl finally is like, you're right, mom. I do have the power. And therefore, I think you and dad should go to couples therapy, which is like our punchline for the call. I like how you said the girl was spitting earlier. This whole call, I was like being you. I was like, this girl's such a little shit. I don't tend to get annoyed at the kids on this show, but in this moment I was like, come on, just let your parents get a divorce. Like, come on. It's like you said, it's like your mom's taking you for a hot air balloon ride. There are people whose parents get divorced and they don't get any of that. I'm actually not speaking from experience. My parents are actually not divorced, so you're probably going to be like, Jane, you don't get what it's like. But I don't know. If my parents had gotten divorced, ripped to everybody else, I think I would have handled it.
Okay, are you ready for a lore drop? Are you ready for a lore drop? My parents did not get divorced, but they should have. Instead, one of them just died.
No, that's kind of how I feel too. Ooh.
Yeah. Like, they should have. Everything would have been better, but mm-hmm. you know, stubbornness. So honestly, I'm kind of against this girl.
I feel like that gives us like honorary children of divorce rights to say this girl's being overdramatic.
Because she is being overdramatic. Like, let your parents get divorced. Like, oh, yeah.
Or to be clear, it's not that I literally think she's being overdramatic. I get that kids, like, of course they're going to act out in this situation. Of course it's really hard to deal with as a child and you don't understand, like, why your parents can't just talk it out. But, like, in the abstract, watching this written TV show as a grown-up, I was like, whatever, girl. Like, you're going to be better off when they're not fighting in the household with you. So
exactly. But hey, at least she can write about this for college.
So true. And she can, like, write her annoying debut novel at the age of 21 about how hard her life was.
Yes.
I don't know why I'm getting, like, so bitter right now. This is what happens when we do these late night recording sessions.
We just make enemies. Make enemies of this little girl. We're like, no, we're Renee Rapp in that clip where she's like, I fought a 7-year-old at a Bears game or whatever.
But anyway,
I'm like, I get that now. I would fight this girl.
But anyway, we cut to the Hen and Karen household. It's bedtime. Hen comes in and she's like, man, bedtime with two kids now. It's like hostage negotiations, you know? I have to do this whole thing with the kids. Karen, meanwhile, is kind of distractedly, like, looking through bank statements on her laptop. She ends up seeing a charge for a teppanyaki restaurant that Hen went to without Karen. And Karen's like, why would you do that? I love teppanyaki. Hen explains that she actually took Chim out for his birthday, but she didn't want to invite too many people, like, for financial reasons. Because, you know, if we invite this person, we'll invite that one. And eventually we'll have to be footing the bill for, like, 20 people. Karen is actually turned on by this. She's like,
wow,
I've never seen...
The frugality is like an aphrodisiac. It's incredible.
Right?
It's incredible.
To Karen, she's like, I've never seen this frugal side of you. They almost are about to get it on. And then they're cock-blocked by the show again by their stupid kids. Right,
they're stupid kids. Hen's game is, like, incredible. Like, she's like sliding up to Karen in bed, etc. She leans in and very softly goes, "I'm thinking about getting a Costco membership."
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Oh, that would have worked on
this
me.
I actually thought about including a mention in my original 911 video about the fact that, like, it seems like Hen and Karen aren't allowed to be, like, as romantic a couple as other couples on the show. And one of my points was going to be that it's like anytime we see them, like, about to get intimate or whatever, which other couples on the show do, they get interrupted by something or someone. And I think you can, like, actually track this. Like, any scene where Hen and Karen are about to possibly have sex, they get interrupted almost every time. And it's like, come on. We're talking about let Buck fuck. Let Hen Rent fuck. Okay?
Yes.
That's
the platform I'm
running on.
We need a titty basadin sex scene between these two gorgeous women.
Well, I didn't say all that, but we need
full
something.
Frontal intimacy.
I didn't say that.
And it needs, it, quite frankly, it needs to be pornographic, but it needs
I
to be directed by a woman too. So it can't be male gazey. You know what I mean?
But anyway, Hen leaves to tend to the kids. And while she's gone, Karen sees Hen's phone get some texts and, you know, like the person who's been cheated on before that she is, she decides to check and she sees that Hen's getting texts from someone named Imelda. And she's like, who the hell is Imelda? Marcos? Right.
I was just thinking that. The First Lady of the Philippines, Ms. Imelda Marcos.
Disgraced former First Lady of the Philippines.
Disgraced former. Right. With all her shoes. Right.
She's like texting Hen like, hey girl, can you get me some more shoes? Is Hen cheating again?
I'm normally very, very against these kinds of invasions of privacy within relationships in media and especially in the real world.
You kind of get it.
You do get it because Hen did cheat before and Karen stayed. So I feel like that it kind of entitles her to every now and again just
checking up on things.
Just check up. Just make sure, you know, that could erode trust in a real relationship. It's a TV show. It's fine. Well, it's not fine because Imelda is being like, hey, do you want to go to the place? And Karen's like, whoa. But we don't have time to linger on it and we won't circle back to it for a while.
Quite
because Bobby stops by Michael's. And who should be there but the kids?
Oh, I thought you were going to say, who should be there Chinese. But Michael?
Who should be there but Michael? No,
hashtag
Michael and the kids,
they're moment, having a little, everybody.
They're having a little Chinese takeout moment. It's very nice. And May just decided to go, you know, hard wheel to the right. Like the, what did that review call her? Like a bratty teen or something like that.
Something like
the
that.
Bratty teen.
Guilt
she
tripping
is.
Daughter or whatever.
Guilt tripping daughter, brings up the realtor rapist.
Well,
oh, wow.
They're specifically talking about how Athena has been working constantly on this realtor rapist case. And Michael very astutely is like, let's not bring that to the dinner table. Let's talk about something else. May mentions that she's making prom plans. She, and this is why when I saw that IMDb review at first, I thought it was about this episode, because May does explicitly mention like guilt tripping in this episode. According to Harry, May guilt tripped Athena into taking her to get her hair and makeup done for prom because Athena couldn't be there to be at May's like dress fitting or picking out her dress. So May is like, I didn't guilt trip. I just mentioned that it was a shame that she couldn't be there. And Michael hears that May is... this is kind of convoluted. Michael hears that May is only planning to take pictures at home for like a half hour and then go take pictures somewhere else. I thought a half hour sounded like plenty of time, but apparently that's not enough for Michael. He's like, come on. And he actually starts explicitly guilt tripping her. He's like, come on. Like, you don't know how much time I'll have. What with my brain tumor? And they all kind of I was gonna say they all kind of laugh about it. That makes it sound weird, but like in the tone of the scene it works, right?
All at home laugh about it, etc. I will say it is funny to see, like, you know, the apple, the tree, like this is where May got it from. It was kind of a sweet moment of like, oh, that's his daughter, you know, that's her dad.
And finally, and May is like, fine, like I'll give you an hour of doing pictures at home. And
because it's
Michael,
the ultimate, like, you know, it's the ultimate get out of jail free. It's the ultimate, like, I win card. Oh, I could be dead from a brain tumor. Bobby's like, well played, my friend. Well played.
We hear that Michael has another scan coming. I forget if in one of the previous episodes Michael had decided to get the surgery or if he just went in for more radiation. Do you remember?
I think he just went in for more radiation and we were all just supposed to be fine with that.
Oh, yeah. For some reason, I thought there was an episode where he like finally realized how much he was freaking out his family and decided to take some other action. But I forget.
Well, I feel like we would remember if Michael got brain surgery.
If he had explicitly gotten brain surgery. Okay. Yeah. Well, who the fuck knows? Michael has another scan coming up and everybody seems pretty sure that he's like probably okay now. Like they don't say that. And of course, Michael is like, yeah, I'm not trying to get my hopes up, but I've been feeling good. And it kind of feels like we're supposed to be like, oh, okay, I guess the cancer storyline is wrapping up now.
I guess his weird anti-medicine screed set to the home song was correct in the end.
Oh my god.
Despite all of our protests. So
yeah, but as Bobby says,
good. That's a good little message.
As Bobby says, you know, in response to Michael still being a little apprehensive about his upcoming scan, the thing about bad news is you never see it coming. Hope that doesn't have anything to do with what comes next in the episode. But we cut to rapist Jeffrey's wanted poster. You'll recall that the realtor rapist was named Jeffrey, aptly, right? Athena and her friend Detective Lou are looking at it at the station. They're sort of pondering how he could have disappeared like he has, how he could have managed to go completely off grid in the year 2020. And we hear that Athena kind of blames herself for losing track of Jeffrey. But they're about to interrogate Jeffrey's past victims for information.
Interrogate?
This very...
No, they're not going to... They're going to interview them.
Okay, yes. But, I mean, there's an explicit mention in the scene of, like, we're not going to use the interrogation room because that would be a little crass.
So you are extra wrong.
yeah, whatever. So we go to like a very kind of grave trauma montage of these poor women being interviewed.
This was not a fun sequence of events. It was it was a series of five women recounting the worst and most traumatic experience of their life. In an episode that to this point has been kind of all fun and games. And I just don't feel like this specific kind of pain works with the tone of the show. The show has had tonal clashes in the past, but you can kind of hand wave it away by like, oh, it's just murder. Oh, it's just a guy getting split in half. You know, but like,
I
when
would
it's
basically agree.
Specifically this kind of pain, it made me uncomfortable because it felt like the everything surrounding it was robbing it of gravity. You know,
I would basically agree. I think the show runs into this occasionally when they try to deal with something a little darker than is typical. And it's tough because, like, at times I think they have succeeded with stuff like Maddie's domestic violence storyline. I think they succeeded at giving that kind of the room and the gravity it deserved. But yeah, this, it feels, it's like one of those Criminal Minds storylines on 911 where they sort of take some time to do a longer storyline that is specifically about, like, one criminal. But, you know, in previous episodes, we've seen, like, oh, the one-off Criminal Minds storyline about, like, the guy who's kidnapping boys to be, like, his surrogate sons. And even that, right, doesn't feel quite as dark. It feels more like this sort of cartoonish Criminal Minds-y kind of case. Yeah. This is, yeah, it's and it's also trying to give us this serious scene about, like, the trauma women face. I'm sorry.
The women
from these types of
trauma
situations.
Face. It's really hard for trauma to face women day
you know,
in and
I'm
day
always
out.
Saying that. I'm always saying that. But this part of the episode tries to really, like, lend some seriousness to the trauma women face in this regard, which, right, I appreciate that, like, right, this is an episode co-written by two women, and also, yes, it doesn't really feel like this knits well enough into the rest of the episode. Like, I think maybe what makes the Maddie storyline unique is that they take the time to have, like, an entire episode or two dedicated to just that, instead of, like, you know, in that episode where Maddie fights Doug, we're not cutting back and forth between, like, Maddie facing off with Doug and, like, an accident at the circus. So I think there is a difference in how the storylines are treated, and I don't
Eddie's
think they quite
buy
pull it
a
off.
New car. Ooh. Shannon's giving him shit about spending so much money because she's a bitch.
right. I think there's a reason for that with the Maddie episodes, and I think it's part of what makes an episode like this not pull it off quite so well.
Yeah. I would have changed it to a different crime. But that's just me, you know?
Or even if they just left it at him being, like, a serial peeping Tom who, like, stalked women, but perhaps was not literally a rapist, and we have to confront all of these rapes, you know, it's kind of, but the main information we're getting from this sequence at the end is that one woman mentions that Jeffrey stole her necklace when he attacked her, and the cops think this means that Jeffrey probably took trophies from all of his victims, which could potentially help them track him down.
He's taking souvenirs, this is going to be sort of the bridge to DNA, right? The bridge to sort of a DNA or just some sort of physical evidence to tie him to the crimes, right? Mm-hmm. Because right now what they have are peephole cameras that were hidden in smoke detectors depicting a man in, like, a balaclava and, like, all black clothing assaulting a series of women. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have any identifying features. So if they do this, it will assuage Athena's feelings of guilt and powerlessness. what she feels is letting him get away. Obviously, it was the system that let him get away. She was busy trying to tie him to the crime. So this is a very important key part of her justice quest. And so we go from that to CAT scans, PET scans, MRIs, whatever
it's
you want to call them. They're different tests, and they have different machines.
At the hospital,
machines.
Michael MRIs is getting what appears to be an MRI.
Terrifying. MRIs sound like the most, like one of the most, like, harrowing things you can experience. And, like, he says later on, like, that it lasted 45 minutes. 45 minutes in this loud, booming tube Well, photographs of your x-rayed brain are taken. This sounds like an absolute personal hell of mine, and I hope that I die before I ever experience one.
Honestly, I think I would chill in there. I think I would just, really? Like, fall asleep. Yeah, I'm not claustrophobic.
My dad, he went in for one, and he said that the only thing that, like, made it, like a decent experience was that he was allowed to hook up his phone to the speaker and play his music.
See, I would just have them interfere. Like put on a podcast. I would get all cozy.
Oh my God, guys, when are we going to get a commenter saying, I listened to this episode during my MRI?
Okay, but anyway, Michael is at the hospital. He's getting an MRI. They're also, to be fair, the part that seems very uncomfortable to me is they're asking him to like hold his breath for 20 seconds. And that seems, he seems to be getting freaked out in the MRI. And we cut to later, he's talking to Athena on the phone. Michael is expressing that he's kind of frustrated and anxious that he doesn't know the results of his tests yet. But it's kind of a short call to hang up. At the police station, Athena is talking to like another officer who has found something on Jeffrey's credit card history. She's not sure that it's much of anything, but she found this one kind of outlying piece of information that apparently he was regularly visiting this coffee shop that was really out of the way from all his other kind of regular locations. So both Athena and this cop are like, what could that be? Like, this might be a lead to something.
If we have time at the end of the episode, we should coffee profile the realtor rapist. I think that would be fun, coffee profiling him.
Well, given that this turns out to be, like, just his place he would go when he was using his storage unit, I feel like it wouldn't have been a cover because clearly, if anything, he shouldn't have frequented this coffee shop because it turned out to be a clue. So assuming he was actually going to this coffee shop just to get his regular coffee that he liked, I'm picturing he gets something really sickly sweet and disgusting, like some kind of like pumpkin spice whipped cream, you know, macchiato, but like in the Starbucks version of it.
Yeah.
With like a bunch of foam. And he's one of those people who gets it with half and half instead of milk. Cause he's like,
oh God,
you know, he just loves cream.
I want to make it even more insidious for this guy. Mm. I envision it as being like a barista's like worst nightmare. So
yeah.
when I was a manager at a Joe and the Juice, we had people come in all the time who ordered iced oat milk, blueberry lavender matcha lattes.
Ew.
And they would sometimes like mix it up and add like, you know, a dollop of cinnamon or like some like whipped cream or whatever. We didn't even have whipped cream, but they would ask for it because it's a juice and sandwich shop, you know what I mean? But like, you know, we would make these like ridiculous like iced coffees, and every single time I saw one come up on like the orders, I would just take a breath, and I would have to physically hold myself back from just like spitting in it a little bit.
Well, let's assume he gets one of those. Anyway, we cut to the dispatch center, and Josh is like having some kind of serious conversation on the phone. Maddie walks into the break room to join
Josh
him.
Josh is being serious.
And as he hangs up the phone, he kind of throws the phone. He's angry. Maddie's like, what's that about? And it turns out the DA has been calling Josh, asking him to make a victim impact statement at Greg's trial. In case anyone doesn't remember, Greg is the bad date guy who gay-bashed Josh and then took the 911 call center hostage.
And his he name took was the Greg. Dispatch 911. Maddie like mentions that they're all, you know, as the hostages, they're all giving written testimonials, etc. But Josh, because he was victimized twice, once in the aforementioned gay bashing and once as a hostage, he has to, and please forgive my terminology here, he has to deliver his orally in the courtroom. And he's struggling with it, I guess, you know? IDK, like he's just like, do I wanna fine, and it's like, well, can I say something mean?
Fine, we've been mean permission. Enough in this episode already.
Permission to be mean. We love Brian Safey for his hamminess. We love him for his iconic memes, deliveries, etc. But there's a reason he's not revered as a fantastic dramatic actor.
Ooh.
And when Josh is given a prolonged, drawn-out, dramatic storyline that occurs in the background, by the way, of the show, you can't ask me to care. You can't ask me to care. This is what's wrong with the gay community. We don't care. But I don't.
I think it's, like, not even so much about the performance for me. It's just, like, the writers don't really care about Josh, you know? I predict, because I remembered that this whole thing culminates in, like, him giving a victim impact statement. And, like, back when the gay bashing, well, possibly gay bashing, I don't know, happened, I was like, you know, this feels a little too dark for it to ultimately culminate in just Josh giving a victim impact statement and nothing else. It feels almost insulting the way this whole thing has been relegated to the background. So yeah, I agree with you that I don't care, but it's like not for a lack of Josh potential. It's just that like the show didn't really care. So why should I care?
Exactly. Like why should we care if they didn't, right? So we don't. Josh, and that scene is short, right?
But Josh is short. He thinks the idea of giving a statement sounds very daunting. He's not sure if he wants to do it, but at the same time not doing it makes him feel like a coward. Quote, he's in jail, but it still feels like he's the one with all the power. So I guess you could say Josh is feeling powerless. And speaking of powerless, we cut to there are a couple tree trimmers about to get down to work. They're outside a woman's house, kind of a swanky neighborhood, right? There's this woman. She is getting really mad at them that they're about to cut down some trees. She's like, you guys are butchers. You're botanical butchers. And the guys are like, we're just following orders, taken up with the city. They have all the power. So I guess you could say they're powerless. And
what she describes the trees as. Because you see like a tree and it's like not in the best shape after they trim it. And she's like, these trees aren't made for crew cuts.
I mean, yeah, it's interesting. But basically the tree trimmers are like, you know, the tree trimming keeps these trees from taking down power lines, which is a very prophetic thing for him to say. And she also, a true thing to say. Yes. And we also see that this woman has like a dumb looking little poodle with her to kind of hammer home like the type of annoying person she is.
Leaves it on the sidewalk because they tell her to fuck off. And then one of them gets in the little cherry picker or whatever. And while the other one is about to hop in, the truck races off. Mm-hmm. And she's in the driver's seat and her little poodle is just there with its leash still attached, just sitting there waiting for mommy to come home.
It's like, girl, maybe take some of this attention you're giving to the neighborhood trees and put it towards caring for your dog. She drives away while one of the guys is still in the tree trimming bucket. That's what he refers to it as. He calls it a bucket. So I guess that's what it's called. She's driving away and she says, who's got the power now? So she's no longer powerless, you could say. But
She really sees the day with that.
She really sees the day. And the tree trimmer in the bucket calls 911. Josh picks up. He's like, you know, this crazy shit happened to me. I've been kidnapped by this lady who's driving away with my tree trimming truck. And then he sees that they're about to run into a power line. Like the top bucket thingy of the truck is going to hit this power line. So he kind of bails and just jumps onto a nearby delivery truck. Luckily, his fall is broken by all the boxes inside the delivery truck. But the woman crashes right into the power lines and like low-key gets electrocuted and starts a fire and starts a blackout. So, you know, bad day for her.
Get fucked.
Yeah. 118 shows up. The power lines are still live. So that's a hazard. The tree trimmer guy is okay. Like I said, the boxes broke his fall. The cops show up and this lady is like, good, they're here for the tree murderers. But obviously, no, they're here for her.
Bobby calls dispatch and has Maddie tell the power company, hey, you got to cut off this section because this car is on fire. He has them get the CO2. They put out the fire, etc. And they ask her, because the transformer pops and sparks. And so it's like, oh, it's off, I guess. That was fast. Her hair is still kind of frizzy. They're like, oh, it's probably static. She probably absorbed a lot of static electricity. Hey, static shock. But then it turns out they didn't actually cut the power. They didn't get there yet. Instead, oh, It's a citywide blackout. Hello, well, we also need summer to mention, is here.
We also need to mention that before the blackout happens, we like cut back to the hospital for a moment for some reason, and Michael is getting onto the elevator. Who should get onto the elevator with him but a hot guy?
A hot guy. Oh my
and
God.
And that's all we know for now. But then we cut back to the car crash. The blackout happens. We see like at the dispatch, all the computers going dark, all the lights going out. Suddenly two cars crash into each other, like right next to the car accident the 118 are already tending to. I guess it's implied that this is
Buck
because
races
the,
off like a dog.
He does. Because he races off like light, a dog. The stoplight wasn't working because of the blackout. So Buck runs off to help. Bobby says before the commercial break in a very cliche way, "This is going to be a long day." That's the kind of thing I would have written into my season 9 outline that we just did on our Patreon.
But it's season 3. It's season 3 and the show's already like this. That's fun. But Buck responds like a dog. It cuts to commercial through the mirror of my mind. Actually, I just saw on Roku, I just saw an ad for China Beach on streaming. And I was like,
the series
I was like, I was Leo DiCaprio in fucking.
Yeah.
I mean, straight sad. Then we cut back from the commercial and Michael in the elevator, that's a, I guess, Be More Chill reference. He is flirting with this. Michael and Hot Guy are flirting hardcore. He is nerding out as an architect and being like, well,
by the
I
way,
guess the
power
generator
has gone out
us,
in the hospital,
you know,
meaning that Michael and Hot Guy are now trapped in the
elevator. Because Michael, he's like, he's nerding out. Oh, the power's out, the elevator stopped, whatever. Yeah. He's like, legally, the backup generator has to kick on. And the guy corrects him and is like, actually, it's only in a situation where a life is on the line. It looks like a big hospital. It could be. It's fine. We'll move past it.
Turns out Hot Guy is a doctor.
Dr. McDreamy over here.
Dr. McDreamy. I was thinking, no offense, but like, what are the odds that two guys trapped in the same elevator happen to both be gay? And not only are they both gay, but they're both like each other's type and into each other. I get that like it's a TV show and these contrivances need to happen. I just was thinking about it in real world terms. And I was like, wow, this would be so lucky. They have to be soulmates.
Maybe the hospital was in West Hollywood. I don't know. it's like very clear. Like just like from the little interaction, the looks they're giving each other, it's like, oh, they're gonna.
They're laying it on pretty thick. The show is. They're like, guess what, everybody? We've decided to give Michael a love interest, and you know that's what's happening now. But whatever.
Michael calls Athena,
or
he calls Athena or work or someone, and he's like, yeah, we're trapped in the elevator. Trapped in the elevator. And then we go from that hot, McSteamy, McDreamy love fest. Yearning, planting seeds, whatever, slow
burn.
Well,
by the way, McDreamy Hot Fest says, look on the bright side. There's worse places to be trapped.
Oh, that's true. Trapped. That's true. He does. And then we get an example because Maddie is at work, right? Because they have their backup generators on. And she gets a call from this dude at the wholesale meat and fish market. And
his name
is
Gordon.
Trapped.
Gordon, who works at wholesale fish and
Gordon
meats.
Is trapped in the walk-in freezer.
Literally my nightmare. I get so cold when I go into the walk-in at work, and I've like got my deli coat on, but like I often will like look around for like 30 seconds. I can't find my Stirado rolls or my whole wheat tortillas or whatever, and then I'm like, well, I guess I'm giving up because I don't want to be in here anymore. And then I go and tell my shift lead like, I couldn't find them, can you go look? Because I hate
Shifley, don't listen to this episode.
I hate being trapped in the walk-in freezer. I hate being in there. I would hate
you know,
to
Gordon's
be Gordon.
Not a fan of it either, Jane. Gordon doesn't like it any more than you do. Because
I don't think
he's calling. And Maddie like tells him, you know, look out for the emergency release knob. Every walk-in, whether it's a pantry or a freezer or whatever, they'll always have an emergency release knob. It was a whole thing in The Shining. But Jack's hand was on it while he was talking to the ghost. There wasn't a ghost. It was just him. But the emergency release knob, it is frozen over because it's a freezer.
Which,
and I guess they don't have...
That seems like a major OSHA thing on the part of the company.
Major OSHA thing. You know, it's supposed to prevent things like this.
Yes. So I would hope that they got, like, majorly audited after this. But anyway,
yeah.
Gordon is up Schitt's Creek. Maddie tells him to look around for, like, things other than frozen meat that he can potentially use to keep himself warm. We cut to a little later, and he's pretty frozen. He's, like, wrapped himself in kind of a plastic tarp, and he falls asleep, which is bad, right? He's more susceptible to hypothermia now. When Eugene arrives, they try to saw open the freezer door, but the saw dies, and they have no more charged batteries because no power, right? They realize that there's an electric release for the door, but with the power out, they can't use it. So Bobby's like, well, why don't we jumpstart it? Cue the Ice Ice Baby needle drop. They decide to jumpstart it with the defibrillator, which is kind of a cute idea. After a couple attempts, they get it to work. They get into the freezer. Gordon is not doing so good. He has passed out. He's hypothermic. Temperature 89.9. But apparently he's okay. And they get him to the hospital.
They just say that. I guess 89.9 is like above the line of like, he dead. Like,
yeah.
they don't want to walk in there like Rob Lowe.
True. True. Oh my God.
I haven't seen that gif in a while. I kind of miss it. I haven't seen that gif in a while.
See, when I tried my one attempt I once made to watch 911 Lone Star, it was pretty much entirely because I wanted to get to the episode where Rob Lowe tries to do chest compressions on a guy and his chest just shatters and his hands go right through him. But I'll be honest, I couldn't get past like episode 3. I was so bored.
Yeah.
No offense to anyone who likes
Although,
that show. No offense.
Apparently,
Justin.
we got a comment on our Patreon that your projected season 9 was apparently made up entirely of Lone Star plots.
No, somebody commented, no offense to this commenter, like, it's not your fault, but they commented, like, wow, a lot of Janes are things that have already happened on Lone Star. I saw that today, and I'm being so serious, it, like, actually bummed me out. I was, like, it ruined my mood. I was like, what? But they only mentioned, like, two things, so I'm hopeful that, like, maybe not all of... I mean, there are things I came up with it that couldn't have possibly happened on Lone Star, right? Like... Not only all my individual calls, but, like, the whole Bobby thing. That can't have happened on Lone Star, right?
I mean, they did Asteroid for their finale, so
right.
They could
I
have
didn't,
done anything.
I didn't do that. They said that my buddy car crash NDE basically happened on Lone Star. I'm like, there's no way. There's
was
no way.
Was it TK
way.
And Carlos? Like, was it? What was it?
Well, yeah, because if it was just a one-off call, I don't think it matters. But if it was, like, a major couple on the show, then it kind of does matter. But also, like, did it enough does. People watch Lone Star that it would matter if my version of season 9 somehow ended up happening?
I mean, Justin did.
Basically, it just made me really sad. I was like, man, are, like, none of my ideas original and I should just, like, give up and, like, never do anything ever again?
Wow, Jane. Give up. Give up, Jane. Never do anything original. All I'm saying...
Are my best ideas no better than 911 Lone Stars?
Is that you got that comment, and I didn't.
It's true.
Nothing I wrote has been done in Lone Star, and that is a fact. A fact.
Anyway, subscribe to our Patreon.
Subscribe to the Patreon.
I refuse to believe that most of the things I mentioned already happened on 911 Lone Star. And if they did... Yeah. No, they didn't. But anyway, Michael and the Hawkeye are back in the elevator. I mean, they're
cleaning
they never left
out
the elevator, but
cleaning
we are back.
Out,
we are
okay?
back watching.
They
them.
Are cleaning
Michael...
out with the Sue Sylvester saw puppet. Okay,
well,
like it is that core.
Good point. Michael is on the phone with the kids. He hangs up, and you know the Hawkeye mentions like, "Are the kids okay?" And Michael ends up asking Hawkeye, "I don't think we even hear his name at all in this episode.
No,
like,
we don't.
Will eventually,
he's just hot.
But he's just going to be Hawkeye for the rest of this episode.
McDreamy.
Sorry, guys." McDreamy. So he asks McDreamy if he has anybody waiting at home for him, like any loved ones he needs to call. And he basically says no. He mentions that he has a dog named Oscar, but that's it. Wow, we got his dog's name, but not his name in this episode.
Oscar's owner over here.
Oscar's owner.
Like, yeah, I'm single and ready to mingle. And then we leave it on that note.
If
Michael's
it wasn't
like,
already...
Oh.
If it wasn't already heavy-handed enough that these two are, like, love interests, now it's like, by the way, I'm single, and also I have a cute doggy at home. But anyway, Athena has arrived at the mysterious coffee shop.
Wait, no. We get an establishing shot of the LA city skyline with the galaxy
well,
over it, the Milky Way.
Oh, okay.
The Milky Way. over the LA skyline.
But that, more like, importantly,
I wanted to appreciate that because Maddie called it out in season two.
True. But more importantly, we get an establishing shot of the mysterious coffee shop that our realtor rapist used to frequent. And guess what is written on the sandwich board in front of this place? The shop is closed, but on their chalk sandwich board is written, quote, "Come try our organic Irish CBD blend, five leaf clover." I just wrote in my notes, what? Like, what is that, a type of coffee? Yeah. Or is this like a coffee shop / dispensary? Why is it Irish? weed is not legal in Ireland, I don't think. No,
I don't believe it is.
You can buy CBD in the UK, so maybe you can in Ireland. But
idea. Maybe it's an Irish coffee. Maybe it's also, they stock Kahlua. Maybe they stock, like, you know, coffee liqueur.
But you're telling me this place has a liquor license and a CBD license?
I don't know how that would be profitable, especially because it seems pretty out of the way. You know?
It seems like such a weird thing on the sandwich board that, like, it must have been a joke that they were just, like, trying to come up with the weirdest thing they could write. But anyway, yeah.
The first question I had about the sandwich board, before I even read it, before I even read the board, I stopped and was like, wait, what does it say? Was because I was so disturbed by the fact that they left the sandwich board out overnight at all. Like, it's chained up, like, you can kind of see, like, a small chain on the inside of it, but, like, just take it inside.
Yeah, why would you
take
not?
It? It's gonna get that stolen. Is this is L.A. What the fuck are
that
you doing?
That being said, why would anyone just steal a sandwich board?
There are a number of uses you could have for it, and I don't know them, but the person who stole it does. True. They have the answers. I don't have the answers. They have the answers, you know?
But across from the coffee shop is a self-storage facility, also closed. Nobody's there. It's also nightfall at this point. Athena calls Detective Liu, asks him to contact the facility manager because she has a strong feeling about Jeffrey's potential connection to this place. So she sees an open door, which gives her an even stronger feeling. She ends up radioing Maddie to tell her that she's doing a business check. So at least, like, Maddie's clued in on this now. As she's looking around, we see Jeffrey lurking in the shadows. So that is not good.
So burning little eyes core. This realtor lurking in the shadows or whatever, about to do some crimes against a woman.
Athena ends up finding a makeshift bedroom. So now she's sure that this is Jeffrey's hideout, right?
There's roaches in there.
Oh,
bed bugs.
Yeah. She tells dispatch that she needs backup to this storage facility. And as she's making this call, Jeffrey attacks her, starts beating
anime
her up.
Anime fight scene, okay?
Well,
it's time for an anime fight scene.
We don't really get an anime fight scene. We kind of just get a harrowing sequence of Athena being, like, beaten within an inch of her life. Now, this is what we were referring to earlier. This is weird for a couple reasons, I think.
Yeah.
Already, it's that thing we were talking about of it being, like, a little darker than what you typically see on 911. Despite this being, like, a show that deals with murder and injury and stuff, it feels a little darker. And also, I mean, I don't know if I should, like, get into it, but I feel like it's kind of weird, right, that, like, so we have this guy who's a rapist, and then he beats up Athena, and it feels like there's this layer of, like, coding there, almost, that, like, if this were, like, a darker story, or, like, a story, I don't know, that felt more comfortable going to this place tonally, like, it feels coded that almost, like,
assault could escalate. Yeah.
Yeah. That this is the place in the story where this guy would, like, sexually assault Athena. And it feels like that's sort of, like, what you would expect from a story like this. And from this guy whose only thing that has been established is that he's a rapist. So I guess I think, and that's not what is true of the story, but I think it's kind of weird that we have this guy set up as a rapist, and then there's an attack, but it's not a rape, and it feels like it's only not because this is, like, a network show, and the show knows that that would be too dark for it. But by not going that far, and they sort of acknowledge that they're not equipped to handle this level of story, which I think signifies that they probably never should have made him a serial rapist, because I think it kind of betrays that they know that that's too dark for the tone of this show, right? The fact that they that they have this only be like a beating. And maybe we should put a content warning on the front of this episode.
Probably. That'd be a good idea. Yeah. I mean, like, I like, it is very true. Like, I, like, personally, I don't go out of my way to, like, engage with a lot of media that involves, like, graphic depictions of men brutalizing women. But, like, you could at least, like, you know, have, like, if it was a different kind of crime, you could have, like, a moment of, like, oh, it's, like, you know, cop versus, you know, criminal, etc. Like, you know, something, something, you know, it's, it feels more like combat as opposed to, like, this kind of harrowing tone, whatever.
Again, it's like, it is, it's like you said, it's coded as being, even though we know it's not a sexual assault, it's like the context of him being a rapist makes the beating darker, which is interesting. I don't know. It would feel like a weird moment.
He was like a, it would be like, you know, less disturbing if he was like a murderer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or if he was like, I don't know. I don't want to like shop the storyline or anything, because like, you know, I have structural problems with it to begin with. And to be frank, I'm not that invested in the storyline as a whole. But it did feel, yeah, it felt uncharacteristically dark and also somewhat indulgent in the, like, it doesn't cut off when he attacks her. Like the yeah. sound of like the radio doesn't cut off. It lingers on the sound of her like being beaten and fighting for survival, and like her,
I mean, the point of this sort of sequence is that everybody's hearing it, and that's what makes it such a harrowing moment, which I can like respect the drama of that. Like, it certainly is a harrowing moment. But yeah, it feels,
the editing of it is like also weird, because it's like set to the Sunshine score. It's like very like strangely indulgent in this kind of violence, you know, which is at odds with the story they set up, you know?
Yeah.
So it made me uncomfortable. And like, I had, not to like, you know, shift the vibe or anything, but I did have a kind of a moment where I was like writing down in my notes like, oh my god, if I was Athena and everyone was hearing me, I'd be so embarrassed.
I mean, in general, it's sort of like the thing we were talking about earlier, where like, you know, when Maddie had her domestic violence storyline, the entire episode was dedicated to that. And kind of because we have the going back and forth in this episode between silly calls and this more serious stuff, it kind of robs the more serious stuff of its gravity. And so I felt that way in this scene, too, that it felt a little like perverse that we were seeing this interspersed with kind of a regular episode of 911. So the other thing I wanted to say is I can appreciate this for being like a dramatic Athena storyline, because we kind of just have to get a couple big dramatic Athena and Maddie storylines every season, because they are our tentpole stars, and like you, the way you convince them to stay on the show is by giving them big moments that they can act in, right? Yeah. And I think this for Angela Bassett is like a storyline that gets to lead into a lot of acting for her, and you see some of it in this episode. So I think that's kind of the meta purpose of this. But yeah, I think the execution and the framing of it all is a little weird for all the reasons we've described.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I feel like there was a way to thread this needle. It's just, okay, so I don't, like, I understand the impetus for a big swing. But, like, between Rage and this episode, I'm not gonna lie, I'm side-eyeing Lindsay a little bit. Just because it seems like she has a common problem of sort of a network TV sort of writer's room writer, where they get their episode and they want to take a big swing with the story. But because they have all of these other storyline-based obligations, and obligations to the characters, and they're not given like a dedicated episode around one storyline, they're forced to condense things and to clutter them around other bullshit. I understand the impetus to go for the big swing in your big episode, or, you know, your big episodes, plural. But on some level, like, it is kind of the mark of, you know, a more conscientious writer to, you know, if you know you don't have the time to execute on these things with the sort of like as thoroughly and with enough dignity as they demand, that you pull back, a little bit, mm-hmm. and you make the scope of your story smaller. That's not what she's been doing so far. So I have a problem with that.
I mean, to be fair, we don't know how much of this is like her specifically, or for one thing, the input of Kristen, who I was going to say, to your point of like the actual sequence of her being beat up, feeling like kind of indulgent with the music and everything. We could kind of, apparently this was the first thing Kristen Rydell ever directed. And, you know, we could blame that on just like her perhaps amateur directing or whatever. Like if that's a direction issue, it's
also very possible.
Her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But also, it's like this Jeffrey storyline was set up by other writers. Who knows whose idea it was? So we don't know that it was like Lindsay specifically who decided to write this event. But yeah, I guess you could say it's been true of like Rage and this episode at least. That yeah, the big swing that maybe doesn't have the most satisfying execution. But what I guess we should describe during this sequence. So we're seeing slash hearing Athena being brutally beaten by Jeffrey. And we're also seeing the drama is that Maddie can hear all of this happening over her radio. She immediately sends backup. She like gets everybody. This reaches the 118 who hear all this. And Bobby like gets the 118 to go to Athena's location and seemingly can also hear what's happening over his radio and is like listening to all. It's a little unclear with the editing, but I think he's supposed to be also hearing it as they're like driving to the location. I was wondering at this point, where is Athena's gun? But that was immediately answered for me because we hear a gunshot over the radio and no one knows who's been shot, right? Which mm-hmm. I wrote at this point, this is pretty good drama. Like,
yeah.
Regardless of our kind of feelings about the framing, like, that's good drama. It's a good idea to have them all be, like, hearing what's happening on the radio but not being able to see mm-hmm. it. Emotional
yeah,
music
starts playing.
Yeah,
it was just the problem
playing.
Was in the execution, yeah. But, yeah, it's good drama. And then they roll up. There's a bunch of squad cars there. The fire mm-hmm. truck rolls up. Bobby breaks out the axe.
He grabs an axe, heads into the building despite it not being cleared yet, and everybody gets there. They find Jeffrey beaten and cuffed and Athena barely responsive on the ground with her gun in her hand. So Hen and Chim start working on her. It's pretty bad. She can like barely talk. She's barely conscious, but she says eventually, she's like, I got him. And I was thinking at this point, it would have been great if Bobby just like chopped off Jeffrey's head with an axe right there.
like
he's like,
Thor.
Guess what? Guess what? I'm going to be judge, jury, and executioner, bitch. But that's not what happens. They take Athena to the hospital. Unfortunately, in the ambulance, Athena asks for Bobby. You know, he's there. This is probably a big episode for Bethena shippers. Mm-hmm. But at the hospital, Michael and Hawkeye, remember this? Oh, remember this? Yeah. Michael and Hawkeye are freed from the elevator and like, ooh, maybe they're going to have a moment. But then Michael gets a call from Bobby about Athena. He runs off. Hawkeye is left bereft. Bars. In the hospital, I was still in the hospital. Thank you. Presumably, Michael just had to like run to a different wing of the hospital, or maybe he had to drive to a different hospital. Who knows?
I think he went and grabbed May and Harry and then went to the hospital.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're
right.
Because we cut to also the hospital, except it's Michael taking the kids to see Athena and he's like preparing them for how injured she is. This is kind of harrowing, you know. He's like telling them to be strong for her because like mm-hmm. from what I'm hearing, like Athena's really badly hurt, right? They come into her room. She's there with Bobby. She's actually not looking that bad. I mean, she still looks like Angela Bassett, you know.
Yeah.
Not to be like crass about it. I just mean like for all that Michael was preparing us, I saw her.
No,
and
but
I was
she's
looking
awake.
As lovely
she's
as ever.
Responsive. She doesn't appear to have any like lingering like
it's
like
not
brain
like
trauma.
On Grey's Anatomy when Meredith gets attacked by a patient and gets her jaw wired shut, and then her kids like cry when they see her the first time. That was a harrowing episode as well.
Did that happen?
Oh yeah. anyway, the kids come in. Harry is kind of scared at first, but Athena is like, come over here, like I need some hugs from my babies. She says it looks worse than it is, and we hear that she has to stay at the hospital for a few days. In typical Athena fashion, she like doesn't want anyone making a fuss over her, but of course Bobby mm-hmm. kind of insists on making a fuss. He's like, I am staying here at the hospital with you because you're my wife and I want to be attentive, which, you know,
there's kind of an emotion underscoring this this need from Bobby to be there, because he says like, you know, let me do this, etc. And it's like, oh, so he's here to be with his wife while she's in the hospital, because his last wife and family burned alive. Remember that? Remember Bobby's backstory?
Well, yes. I haven't forgotten.
And so I was like, oh, okay. So this is like his trauma coming out. Yes. As Bobby begins again and again.
Bobby begins again and again. Back at the Hen and Karen ranch. Remember Hen and Karen had a thing going on in this episode? I didn't. But I didn't. Karen is still suspicious. She's like looking at another thing on Hen's phone. Hen comes in and asks her like if she wants to come to the hospital to visit Athena. Karen lies that she's not feeling well. And Hen is like, okay. At the dispatch, Maddie and Josh are leaving. They're like, well, what a relief that Athena isn't dead. Like, that was scary. I guess it's another thing to talk about with our therapist. They're kind of like laughing it off. Right. Speaking of which, Maddie encourages Josh to talk to his therapist about this whole dilemma of giving his victim impact statement. And she is nudging him towards doing it. She says, you keep saying that you feel powerless. And she thinks that facing Greg and telling him how Josh feels could actually give Josh his power back so that he wouldn't be powerless anymore.
So I don't know how the show is expecting me to care about this. There's been two scenes of this in the episode, and there was nothing last episode or the one before that. It's like, why are you just throwing me back into the mix here? Sorry. But we talked about that already, so it's fine. It's just this episode is not cohesive.
But then we get a part of this episode that I do think is really fun and cute, although
yes.
perhaps shouldn't have happened in this episode, right?
Alternatively, this episode shouldn't have happened around it because we liked this part.
Yes, this part's really fun. Karen shows up at Chimney's door asking him who Imelda is, because he should have been like, disgraced former first lady of the Philippines, Imelda Marcos, but no, he doesn't say that. But she thinks that Hen is cheating on her. Chimney has this great line where he says, what? Hen would never do that. I mean, not after what happened the last time she did that, which is like kind of how we all feel about Hen and her cheating storyline, right? We're like, no, Hen would never do that, except for that time in season one that she did that. exactly. And I really liked the Chimney and Karen dynamic. Like, I wish they would hang out
more.
It's
so
I just love
good.
In any show, so these kind of odd couple pairings where we take two characters who don't usually spend time together and we force them to spend time together. Like, that's always fun. It's always a way to keep things fresh. 911 does not seem familiar with the concept these days, but whatever. Karen presents it helps
that they're both such like they're both such generous like performers. Like, I genuinely feel like both Kenny Choi and Tracy Toms could have chemistry with anyone. They could have chemistry with a brick wall.
I was kind of feeling that way in this scene. I was like, oh, I think part of the reason this works is like they're both such charismatic, kind of working like true professionals of actors,
and they're playing off of each other too so well, just like acting and react. Oh, it's so good. I love them.
But Karen presents, and it's also fun because like as characters, right, these two people are very, very close to Hen, but we don't get the impression that they hang out with each other a lot, so it's sort of a crossover of their two different relationships with Hen. Karen presents like evidence that she thinks she's discovered of Hen's relationship with Imelda. She's like, I wrote down all these dates that she and Imelda were talking about, all these dates they're planning to meet up. And Chimney is like, well, it probably means nothing. But Karen asks him about the teppanyaki restaurant from earlier, right? She's like, is it true that you and Hen went to teppanyaki together for your birthday? And Chim is like, actually, that's not true. That didn't happen. So then he gets mad. He's like, I can't believe Hen used me to lie to Karen. And Karen suddenly is like, do you have anything to drink? And you're like, okay.
Yes.
This is so fun.
We get a fun little callback to the Maddie storyline as well with this, because if you eagle-eyed viewers will remember an iconic moment where Buck pretended to cry over Chimney to use his thumb to unlock the phone. And he asks Karen, did you use her thumb while she was sleeping to unlock her phone? She's like, no, ew, that's weird. And he's like, it's not that weird. Buck did it to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they get absolutely trashed on a bottle of Espolón tequila, and Chimney is pissed. He's so mad because Maddie comes home and finds them, obviously, and so she calls Hen, and Hen rolls up, and they're just on the couch, just like, fuck you.
Presumably, it's like 3 in the afternoon, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the bottle is like 2/3 gone. Like, there's maybe a third of it left, and it'd be so funny
if it was,
like, full. Doesn't
even really seem, like, quite enough for the level of drunk they appear to be. Yeah. But again, it's sort of this thing of, like, Kenny Choi and Tracy Toms being such, like, theater kid actors that it feels like they're both really doing the, like, I'm drunk acting, but, like, in a fun way, not in an overdone way.
Yeah, and Chimney, like, when I say he's pissed at Hen, oh, he's so pissed. He's, like, getting, he's sloppy, and he's getting petty, and he's like, it's so funny.
So Karen and Chimney confront Hen over the suspected lies and betrayal, and Hen denies cheating, but Karen shows the texts and the meetup times, and Hen is finally like, okay, Imelda is Dr. Royce, which Chimney's like, who the hell, like, she's a doctor? But
Karen is better than the last one.
But Karen reveals that Dr. Royce is the surgeon Hen met when she did the thoracotomy and had to go into the OR, right? And Chimney also has a good line where he's like, which was really stupid and reckless, by the way. So I was like, wow, he agrees with me, my take on that episode. Also, Chimney is still chewing gum while drinking tequila, which is very gross, but also a great character choice. You know,
a great character choice.
But Hen's like, it wasn't a meet cute, it was just a meet. I've been talking to Imelda about, like, what it's like to go to med school, and the dates are dates I can take the MCAT. Turns out Hen's thinking about going to med school, and she's been keeping it secret because she thinks it's this crazy idea. She hasn't settled on it yet. She's kind of afraid to tell people.
And Karen immediately melts. She's like, oh my God, wait, you will be the best doctor ever. I'm sorry I doubted you, baby. I love you. And it's very lovey. And then the camera pans over to Chimney on the couch, and he's just sitting there like, Karen's like, I'm so happy for you. Chimney's like, I'm not. And then drinks more tequila. And it's like, oh, he doesn't want to lose his partner and best friend. Aww. Yep.
But back at the Grant household, Michael is checking in on Bobby.
Do we have to move away from this scene for a second? I just, like, I want to stay with them. I love Madney and Henry.
I want the episode to be over. So at the household, Michael is visiting Bobby to check in on him. Bobby admits that he's not doing so well, but he's managing, right? Mm-hmm. And they kind of commiserate over how, like, they know that being in danger is part of Athena's job, but there's a big difference between, like, knowing about that in the abstract and seeing and hearing it. Bobby says, it makes you feel powerless, just in case you forgot the title of this episode. Bobby says he keeps thinking about, you know, what would have happened if Athena had died. Like, he knows it didn't happen, but he can't stop thinking about it, and he doesn't really know what to do with that feeling. And Michael is like, why don't we fucking destroy this house's fireplace with sledgehammers to get our man emotions out? And so they do
that. So he prompts this by saying, well, I keep thinking about this thing that a very wise man once told me. You know, I can't ease your troubles or whatever, but I can give you a hammer. And it's like, oh, it's flashing back to Rage when Bobby took Michael to the Rage room. Lindsay, this is so self-indulgent, but I respect it.
Can we say, though, why are they not just going back to the Rage room? Why are they destroying their own property? Why not
just go
to
the... Because they already did the Rage room. And they didn't like the fireplace, apparently. They're going to take out an entire fireplace. An entire fireplace.
It's like a fireplace.
He's
going to
be over
it's
like a
those...
third of the way through. You know what I mean?
It's one of those things that's like, that it's a fireplace that seemingly like goes all the way up to the ceiling. It's sort of like an embedded fireplace, which I was
like
is that
chimney?
Load bearing? Is that thing load bearing? We should check in on this before we just go tearing it down willy nilly. But
there's
anyway,
this
they even acknowledge load bearing
chimney you shouldn't have removed.
they even acknowledge that Athena will kill them for this, but they do it anyway. I was like, really? Athena's already in the hospital, okay, badly beaten, and you're about to destroy her fireplace. For all we know, maybe Athena loves that fireplace. I just think they shouldn't have done it.
I mean, it's a beautiful fireplace. I would have loved that fireplace if that was in my house. I would have read a book around that every night with a glass of wine. She probably does that every day.
But apparently it's not good enough for Michael and Bobby. But we go to the family taking May's prom pictures in Athena's hospital room, which is cute.
We get a needle drop, and I didn't recognize the song, but I had a really harrowing thought where I was like, this came out in 2020. Did the singer of this needle drop ever become anything? Because I didn't recognize the song or the voice. It may have been Alessia Cara, but I don't know. But like, yeah, they go to like a little montage here. They're taking
I thought you were setting up that like you looked up the song and it turned out it was like an early song by like Benson Boone or something.
No, I don't know. I didn't put any work or thought into that. I had that thought.
Oh, it says it was by Maren Morris. I've heard that name.
Oh, that was a Maren Morris song. Oh, I like Maren Morris. Yeah, she's someone. Okay, I guess I just don't know the song then. All right, well, sorry for the shade, Maren. Did y'all catch the Maren Morris shade? I like her music. I like her. But don't quote me on that if she's ever done anything problematic. Okay, don't quote me on that.
Okay.
But okay, so good for Maren Morris.
She got in Nashville. They should have her on 911 Nashville
with Leanne Rimes. Yes,
yeah.
And we get the montage set to the apparently Maren Morris song, where they're doing the prom photos in the hospital. May and Darius are looking cute for their prom. May's dress is very beautiful. Her hair is done. Her makeup looks so right. She looks great, and she gives this weird little speech to Athena about how she wants her in the photos.
Let's talk about it.
Because she's finally, I mean, I'm adding in the word finally, but she's finally proud of her cop mom. You got the bad guy.
It's
wow.
a little weird,
My
right? It's a little weird.
My character is complete, I guess.
Well, yes, May has this thing. She wants Athena. She wants to take some prom pictures with Athena. And at first, Athena like doesn't want to be in the pictures looking the way she looks, like covered in bruises in her hospital gown, whatever. And May like gets up in her face and she's like, I see you and I'm proud of you for getting that bad guy. And it's like, yeah, it feels like spiritually it is a follow-up to the whole thing in this season of May like being ashamed of her cop mom living with the enemy, etc., etc. And obviously, like, I would be proud of my cop mom too if she had just gotten like beaten up catching a serial rapist. Like, even if I in the abstract am not a huge fan of cops, I would still be able to acknowledge like, okay,
yeah,
broken clock right twice a day. And also, it's like, this feels like such a kind of cheap and unfair way to quote-unquote wrap up that storyline. It's like, just because a cop occasionally does a valiant thing doesn't mean that like May's criticisms were invalid before. And I know that that's not what the show is like coming right out and saying, but having this as the culmination to her arc this season does feel like this deliberate thing of like, well, May's finally come around, right?
And like to have it in like the closing montage of the series semi-finale, like that, like not the series, the season semi-finale. God, no. season semi-finale. Can you imagine? It ends on season 3. It's like, wow, those first two seasons were pretty good, and then you can see why it was canceled. the season semi-finale in the wrap-up montage, it just feels so tacked on and just very didactic, like on a meta sense from the writers. Like, this is why May was wrong, and you can see that she actually does respect the cops, so everyone watching at home should also respect the cops. And she had nothing, you know, to add of value in her living with the enemy crap that I personally didn't sign off on. Kristen and Tim and Lindsay.
And it's like, we understand, listeners, that like that's not literally what the show is coming right out and saying, but like that's kind of the takeaway you get watching this season as a whole, especially considering I don't think we ever revisit May's feelings of like anti-cop sentiment.
No.
It kind of
this
just feels like, you know,
up.
Story opened, story closed.
But thankfully we go away from that, so we don't have to linger on it any longer than that. We can just sit with the sadness.
Well, okay, we get like a 1 second cut to Josh on the phone agreeing to give his victim impact statement. Like, as if the rest of the episode, as if the rest of this storyline hasn't been you know, such an afterthought prior to this. It's like, oh yeah, 1 second of Josh resolving his thing. The show is just so attentive to his character.
I wouldn't even say it was tacked on. It doesn't feel like that intentional or even with the permanence of like a thumbtack. No. It feels like they took the gum right out of Chimney's tequila, you know, besotted mouth and, you know, put it on the wall and gave a little note card with Josh's wrap up for the episode and stuck it on there. Yeah. And it's like, well, we'll see how long it sticks. God. But yeah,
sorry,
so we a one second of him being like, yeah, I want to give my statement, actually. I don't need to think about it or have any screen time. And then we go to Matt in the apartment, and Chimney's just sad because Hen's going to be a doctor, okay?
Yeah,
and
he can't really accept that Hen is leaving him.
Hen, she, you know, Karen gets her dolled up in her MCAT swag, Dr. Wilson. Dr.
And
Henrietta
presumably
Wilson, anybody?
They finally fuck after this.
One assumes.
We didn't see it happen, so who knows?
But then we go back to May and Darius taking prom photos with Athena in her hospital bed. It's sweet. It's sweet. It's nice. Everyone looks great except for Athena, mm-hmm. obviously, but she's still looking great because she's Angie Bassett.
Yeah, then, I would say just no caveats. She's also looking great.
I agree with that. Because
I respect
I
women
that.
Everywhere. Okay, and I think all women are queens.
Well, you know what? That makes one of us. So. Ooh. But we go from that to the best part of the episode. Guys, the best part of the episode because...
Sort of a cold close here where there's a 911 call. Maddie answers. There's a woman reporting a train crash. The caller really sounds like she knows what she's talking about. She's like, here's all the backup we're going to need. Here's whatever, whatever. And Maddie's like... You sound like you've done this before, which again is like not a thing I think a 911 dispatcher would say. It's like, okay, just listen to her, get help. But the reason she knows what she's talking about is it's Abby Clark. Okay, cut to Abby Clark on
Abby
a crashed train.
Clark.
Her train
on our
has derailed
once again.
And she says,
looking
I used to
gorgeous.
Be a 911 dispatcher. And it's like, we know, girl, we haven't forgotten. But clearly the show is expecting us to.
Do you guys remember when the show had so much sauce? When the show had sauce out the ass? When
and
Abby
this
Clark
hasn't
was
even
on
been a very saucy season, but like this is a saucy ending, okay?
Oh yeah, and then we pan back from her at the window. Am I using pan? I'm not. We pull back from the window.
We do sort of we pull back. We get sort of a big dramatic zoom out, a reverse close up. I believe is what they call this during the French
New Wave.
We get
a reverse. Close up, like zooming out from Abby to taking the full breadth of this absolute fucking disaster. The train, one of the cars is wedged in the ground up at like a 75 degree angle. The rest of them are scattered to the wind. It, like when she says this is a mass casualty event, this is a mass casualty event. How did this happen? How was it hit by another bigger train?
Yeah, I feel like this is the kind of thing that like doesn't even really happen in America anymore because we simply just like don't have enough trains, but it does happen. And yeah, there's been a big train derailment. Maybe, okay, if we put a little more public money into the train systems,
we wouldn't
have a lot of accidents and we could have some high-speed rails connecting some major cities.
Zoran Mamdani is on the phone for you.
Zoran,
the name
do you want a guest
Mamdani.
On the pod? Mamdani, do you want a guest on
the
pod? The
name
I'm a big fan
Mamdani.
Of your mommy's movies.
Mamdani. That's my mayor. That's my mayor. Sorry.
Is that from something?
Someone did a remix of Incredible Zoran Moments where he was like mashed up with the hit 2006 single by American singer-songwriter Gwen Stefani, Hollaback Girl.
Yeah.
Oh, I should clarify. Wizard of Oz contemporary reimagining producer Gwen Stefani.
Oh, that's right. That's right. She and Blake are trying to make their Wizard of Oz remake. Isn't the world full of wonderful things?
Wonderful wizards, even. But that's where the episode ends, on that cliffhanger. Abby's back. train derailment. How's the train hanger? Hello. How's the 118 going to respond to this one? Find out next week on the First Respodcast. Buck drama. Buck drama. Hello.
Buck drama. I don't even really remember anything about this finale other than it being a train derailment with Abby. I remember Eddie saying that line with so much venom where he goes, Abby, his, or no, what does he say? Abby, his fiance's Abby. And I only remember that one because people share it on 911 Twitter all the time. I guess we're going to see for sure, because I was just seeing some more Abby Clark hate on the TL a few weeks ago. And I was trying to remember if the finale of this season makes her look bad or not. Because like
it does. No, I remember it making her look pretty bad. I'm not going to lie.
So, okay. So depending on how it depicts her, I guess I'll see how much more leeway to give Abby haters. I'm thinking it's, no matter what, it's still not going to be that much.
Yeah.
Just the things these like women on 911 Twitter will say about Abby. I'm like, you guys need to go back to the feminism re-education camps because you guys are not, it's not what you think it is. And I'm not saying anyone has to love Abby, but it's like the vitriol people have for her over these things that are objectively not a big deal or are objectively just not that bad. Like,
yeah,
it makes me 100% feel insane.
And with that, we can say a wonderful good night. Thank you guys for listening. This has been,
I just want to say, I don't know why I said mommy earlier when I was talking about Zoran Mamdani's mother, Mira Nair. And I just want to say, if she's listening, Mira, I didn't mean to demean you in any way. I was just trying to be funny.
Well,
Zoran, if you want to come on the podcast, I love your mother's wonderful films and I respect her as a person and a woman.
Hey, I'm a New Yorker. I'm a New Yorker and I'll be voting for Zoran in November. So he can, if he wants my vote, he'll come on the pod.
Let's get him in trouble for voter fraud.
Everybody loves Curtis Silva.
And I can't vote in New York, but if Zoran wins, I will marathon every single Mira Nair movie.
If you guys like our show, don't be afraid to support us. You know, follow us on social media at First Risk Podcast, spelled how it sounds.
I think you should be afraid to support us. Be very afraid.
I did post some unhinged things this week. And if you want to support us further, you know, subscribe to our Patreon. We just put out our newest Patreon bonus episode that we do every single month. It was pitching our ideal 911 season 9s, Jane's version and Ryan's version. And
we must say, so far, it's getting rave reviews. We went in wildly people are loving directions. It. So if you want to know what everybody's talking about this month,